The matter of Rise Against Hate versus Cherry Hill Township et al. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Walter Lourdes of Cone, Brooklyn, Cumberland, Permanent Council, appearing for Mika Cherry, New Jersey Foundation for Open Government and Libertarians for Transparent Government.
Michael J. Wiles from Brown and Connery, on behalf of the respondents, Township of West Deptford, Township of Cherry Hill, and their respective custodians of record.
Matthew Flynn from Sabo Shaw on behalf of Respondent Township of Bridgewater and their records custodian Linda Doyle.
Good morning, Alexander Shalom from the Township of Bridgewater.
Mr. Woodward?
Good morning, Your Honor. Carl Woodward of the firm of Corella Byrne in Roseland, New Jersey, on behalf of the New Jersey State League of Municipalities and the New Jersey Institute of Local Government Attorneys. And thank you for accommodating my illness.
Happy to have you and happy to accommodate you. Welcome, everyone. With six counsel for this issue in front of the court, I would encourage as many of you as possible to adopt arguments that have preceded you to the extent you're comfortable doing so. We'll hear first from C.J. Griffin, please.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
That is fine.
Thank you. May it please the court. The issue in this case is fairly simple. And I say it's fairly simple because it's the third time in about 5 years that the issue of personal contact information, whether it's subject to that, has been before the court. There's no need for this court to stray from its analysis in Brennan, which was reaffirmed just 2 years ago in Bozzi versus Jersey City. The statutory analysis is the same for email addresses as it was for home addresses. I won't give you the full analysis because it's in our briefs, but I'll give you the highlights. When it enacted OBRA, the legislature exempted only one piece of contact information across the board, unlisted telephone numbers. It also created a privacy study commission to study privacy issues and make recommendations for additional exemptions. The privacy study commission heard testimony, studied the issues, and made recommendations. And the two of the recommendations were that the legislature should exempt all home addresses and all email addresses. It also specifically warned the legislature that towns create newsletter email lists and that someone could request them and they would be subject to OBRA if they're not exempt. Despite that warning, the legislature never adopted a broad exemption for home addresses or email addresses. And instead, it's amended OBRA numerous times over the years, but it only exempted home addresses and email addresses in select circumstances. This court, and Brennan and Bozzi said that this legislative history strongly cautions against the creation of a judicial exemption for that personal contact information. In this case, despite that strong caution, the appellate division applied one anyway for email addresses, despite finding that the privacy interest was minimal. This case is very much like Bozzi and Brennan in terms of that legislative history, but it's even simpler than those cases because the plaintiffs have requested less than the plaintiffs did in those cases. And Brennan and Bozzi, it was the name and address, home address, and some other piece of information that the agency claimed created a privacy interest. So in Brennan, it was the name, address, and the fact that the person had purchased collector's items, valuable sports memorabilia from a public agency that would make them targets of theft, that created the privacy interest, which is and in Bozzi, it was a name, address, and the fact that they had owned and licensed a dog that allegedly created the privacy interest, which this court also rejected. In other words, Brennan and Bozzi are not about the mere list of home addresses. They're about addresses, names, and other pieces of information about a person. And in this case,
let's take just a moment. Please go ahead, do whatever you need to. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Those cases were about names, addresses, and other pieces of information about a person, and this case is only about a list of email addresses. Bozzi dictates the court's full analysis in two sentences. To quote Bozzi, our decision in Brennan clearly precludes any reading of OBRA that would provide an overarching exemption for the disclosure of names and addresses. It is therefore the ownership of, and licensing of a dog that would have to provide a reasonable expectation of privacy for Jersey City to make such a colorable claim. And it is here that Jersey City's claim fails. In this case, there is no exemption for email addresses either, and that's all the plaintiff seeks. And so the defendant's claim also fails. There's no additional analysis that's needed. OPRA's privacy provision is not an invitation for courts to legislate from the bench or decide what should or should not be accessible. OPRA's privacy provision is instead a safety measure to make sure that highly private information about people that the legislature never could have envisioned becoming public or being requested does become public. That's not the case here. The legislature was warned that people could request email distribution lists. It knew that email addresses existed at the time, but it chose not to create an exemption at the time it enacted OPRA, and it chose not to create an exemption in response to the Privacy Study Commission. The discussion that we're going to have today here will be robust and thoughtful, and I'm looking forward to it. I love these sort of debates. Everyone's going to share their opinion, and I know the court will listen to them seriously. All of the amici in this courtroom shared their opinions with the Privacy Study Commission. Some of the organizations here had members of their organizations on the Privacy Study Commission. We've all weighed in, but the discussion we're going to have here today really belongs with the legislature and not with the court. Some members of the court might not like the fact that email addresses are subject to OPRA. They might create legislation differently. But the fact that email addresses are not exempt is a legislative decision, and it's one that this court should respect. The court has always applied the privacy provision very sparingly, and I encourage it to do so again. So therefore, plaintiffs respectfully ask that you reverse the appellate division's decision. That concludes my presentation, if the court has any questions.
Following up on the point you made about going to the legislature, is this question that we have before us today part of the discussion that is taking place with respect to a potential amendment to OPRA, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, I don't know if it's included in the bills. I haven't focused on it. I've been focused on some of the very alarming provisions that eliminate fee shifting and that sort of thing. I certainly could get back to the court on that, but I'm not certain. And to the best of my understanding about the pending legislation is that there's going to be new bills, and we have no clue what will be in them. And so that's where we are.
What about this request relates to the function and or operation of government? And isn't that why OPRA was created in the first place, to make that available and transparent to the public?
Well, that's a good question, and that's certainly part of the debate, right? And so I would say a few things to that. First, you only get to the purpose of an OPRA request when you get into the actual privacy balancing test. So this court did not get to the purpose when in Brennan or Bozzi. Bozzi in particular was a commercial requester that just wanted the home addresses so that he could sell his dog fence, but the court ordered disclosure. So there's no public interest in that reason why he requested it. But I think if you did get into a public interest and use the balancing test, I think that there are some here. And I discussed this in my brief in response to the ACLU and the League of Municipalities. So there is a theory called the derivative use theory, and this court really alluded to it in Burnett.
I just want to know about the function and operation of government. If that's the purpose of OPRA, to make that public, to make the public aware of it, what about this request has anything to do with that? And what, if anything, do the members of the public whose emails addresses are going to be disclosed in any way relate to the purpose of OPRA?
Well, I would say two things. First, I would disagree with the fact that the sole purpose of OPRA is to reveal functions of government. A lot of government records just document activities. So, for example, land use records don't necessarily reveal functions of government. They could. But they just document transactions between people, and the government serves a role as being the records keeper. But going to this particular request, I think that the derivative use is that they intend to use the list to tell people about the functions of government. This is an organization that studies various issues relating to hate crimes, relating to racial justice.
So it's only the derivative use that would fall under the category of the purpose of OPRA. It's not just getting emails, as Justice Solomon is requesting, just getting these emails that citizens of these townships have provided to their township in order to get emails from the township.
Yeah.
How does that promote transparency in government? How does that go towards the goals of OPRA, aside from the derivative use?
Well, I don't think we can disregard the derivative use. So the document...
Without the derivative use...
Without the derivative use, it's a list.
It has no purpose. Right.
Without a derivative use, it's a list. But that is also true, for example, of the land use records in Burnett. They don't reveal anything about the operations of government, but the court alluded to the fact that if someone requested those same records, the balancing test could come out differently if they were requesting it because they were studying the practices of government. Take something like a motor vehicle accident report. Unless it involves a public official or employee, it's a public record. It largely doesn't reveal anything about the operations of government on its face, but it could if you requested many motor vehicle accident reports and looked into the way in which accidents are investigated and those sort of things. Traffic tickets on their face just reveal that a ticket was issued, but many of them together could reveal something else. So the court always considers negative derivative uses. That's the whole argument on the other side, that there could be negative derivative uses of this document, that people could phish, scam, also identity theft. Those are negative derivative uses. But there's also positive derivative uses. And one is distributing information about the government to the public. These are reports about disparities in the local police departments. Another, which I cited numerous articles in my brief, where there's so many times where governments remove people from mailing lists, whether they're citizens, gadflies they don't like, or members of the press from the press list. Accessing the actual list allows reporters to fact check that removal. So
in this case, it's fairly generic. Civil alerts notified me, the mayor's weekly update. But what if it's a specialized list that a local government is keeping? For example, an email list of people with disabilities who need a particular form of transportation and giving announcements.
I think that would be different, Your Honor, because then that would be revealing something, that other piece of information about the people, about the public.
With BOSI, the other piece of information we talked about and during argument of that case, and that was the dog ownership. But it seems to me there are a number of email lists that government could be using. But, you know, who has a burglar alarm? Who doesn't, obviously? Lots of different specialized functions that government sends out. Government may send out emails on that would, in fact, be very intrusive on people's privacy.
Yes, our argument today isn't that there couldn't ever be a circumstance where an email address list or an email address could be confidential. I think those are special circumstances, and they're different from the generic ones that my clients saw here. So if the email list was something that would reveal health information, a list or security information, a list of contacts for people who have alarms, that would be different. And then you would go to that beyond Brennan. BOSI sort of had that statement I read to you sort of had two pieces. It said there is no broad-based exemption for home addresses, so there has to be something else. Here there is not the something else. And in BOSI, they found the dog ownership was something else that could require non-disclosure. But here there is no something else. And so it ends with deference to the legislature here. And again, this is something that the legislature can consider. It's been recommended to them, and they didn't act.
I have a question about the privacy provision that you talked about in your opening statement. So OPRA already exempts disclosure of social security numbers, credit card numbers, driver's license numbers, unlisted telephone numbers. Then we have the privacy provision that directs that public agencies have the responsibility and obligation to safeguard from public access a citizen's personal information with which it has been entrusted when disclosure would violate a citizen's reasonable expectation of privacy. So social security numbers, credit card information, phone numbers, driver's license, those are already out. What is left that falls under this privacy provision? Because it seems as though, because your argument is there is no colorable claim. There was no colorable claim in BOSI. There's no colorable claim here. It seems as though there really is nothing left that would meet this colorable claim, right? And I'm struggling to understand at this point what is left of that privacy provision if pretty much most of the personal information that we used in today's world is something that you're arguing would always be pretty much always be accessible through the government agencies.
Well, as I think I have a couple of responses. One, contact information largely is available. So email addresses are not exempt under Rule 138. You don't redact them from complaints. They're in documents and that sort of thing. But for the privacy provision, what it does protect are deeply personal details. So the court has applied it in Carter as to someone's financial disclosure or financial relief application for firefighters, because that's something that wasn't codified in any exemption. The court applied it in Brennan, where the law, and Burnett is kind of a wonky case, but because the legislature made Social Security numbers public in certain circumstances, but the court nonetheless said the legislature couldn't have envisioned that request, which was millions of records that had Social Security numbers and home addresses and signatures and names, and that the legislature couldn't have envisioned that, and so it required Social Security numbers to be redacted consistent with the rest of OPRA, as well as identity theft laws and those sort of things. There's a case called Asbury Park Press versus Township of Lakewood that's a published law division case where it's about 911 calls. 911 calls are almost always subject to OPRA, according to published case law. They're released, but in that particular case, the court found that the call was pretty horrifying, that it was recording someone screaming and their dying words, and that there wasn't really a benefit to the public that justified overcoming the privacy of the family that would have to hear that. In PATH versus Ocean County Prosecutor's Office, the court didn't find that the privacy provision applied there, but it alluded to the fact that if a body camera or dash camera recorded, for example, a sexual assault, that would be something that might outweigh the public's interest in learning about the officer's conduct. So I think there's, especially when it comes to video and those sort of things, there's lots of times that the privacy provision could come into play where there's a deeply personal private health information and that sort of thing at stake.
But the statute says a citizen's personal information that would violate a citizen's reasonable expectation of privacy. It doesn't say deeply personal, well, I can't remember the phrase you just used. It says the citizen's personal information. What is personal information under this provision if
emails,
phone numbers, none of that information that I think most people would consider pretty personal?
So I don't know that most people consider it that personal, and the legislature didn't. It didn't choose to, it chose to include email addresses, for example. It called it personal identifying information in a later exemption for firearms licenses. There was legislation because they didn't want reporting that had happened in New York that put a map out of all the firearm permits in the town. So they created an exemption, and in that exemption, they exempted not only the names and addresses of people who had firearms, but also their email addresses.
I understand that there's no broad exemption for email addresses in OPRA as a whole, but it also does not seem that that is what the appellate division did here. Just because on the same day as this decision, we have the decision in Brooks, which specifically holds that the email addresses are discoverable under OPRA, and specifically goes through how in that case there was no reasonable expectation of privacy because the person was having this back and forth communication with a government entity. So how do you square that with your argument that a court cannot analyze this specific provision, 47.1A.1, that talks about personal information and reasonable expectation of privacy because it has to just be left to the legislature to create this bright line rule, where the appellate division here wasn't creating a bright line rule. Instead, it was specifically analyzing a particular context and saying, in this context, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in your email address. In this context, there is.
Well, I agree with their decision in Brooks. Like, it's absolutely correct, and it would be detrimental to government transparency if we couldn't see the email addresses of who's communicating with government. And I won't tell you the war stories, but there have been plenty of them where the email address revealed something important. So yes, the appellate division made a distinction, but I think it's a distinction that the legislature should make, and it's not consistent with.
Would you be taking the same position with respect to email addresses that had names attached and addresses?
Yes, because my response is, one, there's not evidence of that in here. Two, people freely give out their email addresses more, I think, than
some people. And some people.
Well, they freely gave it up to the government here.
It's their township. They gave their email addresses to the town where they reside to receive information from their township. they entrusted their information with their town. There might be people that give out their email addresses freely, and there are a lot of people that only give their email addresses out to specific entities in anticipation that their email address will be safeguarded by that entity. I don't think the argument that, well, people generally give their emails out all the time is a reason why we should disregard this privacy provision, because I think there is a reasonable expectation by many citizens that if they give something to the government, a government entity, the government entity is not going to be a clearinghouse for local businesses, for nonprofit groups, or for anyone who simply wants to obtain their information, which is what you're advocating.
I think that's a question for the legislature, though, not for the court.
Well, we have a privacy provision that we have to interpret.
But it is not a license to legislate. I think that BASI has the correct statutory analysis. It was 2 years ago.
But BASI, like every single other case and instance you cite, involves disclosing information about somebody or a group that requested some activity, some government activity or function. In BASI, it was, I guess, the licenses. In every case, where is the case where the information is requested because you want a list and nobody has requested any government action, granting a license, granting a permit, granting anything, or even recording for tax purposes your deed?
What's that instance? I don't think that BASI focused on that. They focused on the legislative history and law.
Every case you cite discusses an instance where somebody requested, asked for some government action. This is not that case. This is the exact opposite case.
It is a government action. It's receiving information from the government. That is a government action just as much as registering your dog. I think BASI is distinct in that in BASI, and Justice Pierre-Louis, your dissent goes into this, use the phrase required by law or compelled to give this information to the government. You had no choice, but unless you wanted to violate the law, you had no choice but to make your name, address, and dog ownership public.
But there is another aspect of this, and that is that the purpose, as I think, of getting an email from government, which may in fact tell you when there's going to be a planning board meeting or a municipal council meeting or whatever it may be, is government transparency and better communication with citizens. It seems inevitable that if you prevail in this case, there will be perhaps many citizens of towns and our many municipalities in New Jersey who say, I want my name off that list because all of a sudden I'm getting emails I don't want. I don't know what they're doing with my email address. I don't want to get ads for, you know, orthopedic shoes and everything else that comes with a disclosure of email addresses. Now I'm older, so I get orthopedic shoes ads. But whatever it may be, and all I wanted was the newsletter. So I'm off the newsletter. Thank you very much. And I would think that perhaps municipalities will have to tell people if you give us your email address, it's going to be open to potential disclosure under OPRA. So.
Right.
We're talking about an impact that may, in fact, be antithetical to the purpose of better and more open communication between government and citizens. And that isn't present in BASI because...
Well, I think it is, and it was in Justice Pierre-Louis' dissent. She was concerned wouldn't register...
My dissent didn't carry the day.
She was concerned that people wouldn't register their dogs, which I think is actually a greater harm than someone not... receiving the newsletter.
Well, it's not just the newsletter, though. These townships communicate about road closures, about flooding in certain areas, about, you know, other situations in town that the citizens need to be informed about.
So
I don't think the simple answer is, well, just check, you know, the township website every 5 minutes to see if there's any updates on what's going on in town. I think, you know, to Justice Patterson's point, this these listservs for these townships to communicate with the citizens are important for government transparency. And, you know, and I, you know, I wrote a lot in my dissent, but again, I was in the dissent. The majority focused on the fact that, you know, registering the dog and having a dog, that was a very public endeavor. No one's hiding the fact that they have a dog. I don't see how this case is similar to, as Justice Solomon noted, what has occurred in other cases. If someone, being, again, a good citizen, decides that they want to receive information from their township, one-way communication between the township and a giant listserv, there's no, I don't see what is public, what is a public endeavor about that.
I think it is public because you're asserting yourself into public business and asking to receive information. But I also think that there's a couple of things. The harm that could flow, and you discussed this in your dissent, and it was beautifully written. I'm glad it didn't carry the day, but the harm that could flow there is not only that people wouldn't register dogs, but also domestic violence victims, could their home addresses could be identified. People can come to your house. It's why the legislature has chosen to exempt the home addresses of judges, but not your email addresses. The harm there, like, I was a Jersey City resident. My home address was going to be given out. I could receive the dog fence thing. It would be annoying to me. I couldn't change my address and remove myself from that list unless I chose to violate the law or to move. And so it was public. With an email address, yes, some people might not like that they get spam. They can unsubscribe. It will probably be caught by a spam filter. But they could also just create another Gmail account and subscribe with that one. So there's not the same type of harm that flows. Gmail addresses are free. I cite sources in my brief showing most people have more than one email account. Most people have email accounts that they use to sign up for what they call spam, to register for websites, those sort of things.
That may be so. Maybe most people in this room, maybe most people who are in the legal profession do. But the fact is to say, well, the citizen can take action and set up a separate account to get town newsletters and a whole bunch of other things that are apparently going to come in, because this is obviously not going to be the group that you are representing only. There could be 100 organizations and merchants and everything else that are suddenly emailing somebody. And to say, okay, citizens, all you got to do is set up another account. There's something antithetical to communication with government going on. Whether that carries the day or not, I don't know. But
I understand the concern. I would say again, it was a legislative choice. The legislature, when it enacted OPRA, it did contemplate emails. It exempted emails to themselves, something we've all lamented about over the years.
But the legislature exempted itself entirely.
No, the legislature is subject to OPRA. It falls in the definition of a public agency. There's two exemptions. We sort of shorthand and say that because there's two exemptions that sort of exempt everything we'd really want to know, which one of which is communications with constituents, which is defined as almost everybody, and that includes emails. So the legislature had emails on its mind and chose only to exempt unlisted phone numbers. And then the pieces of legislative history I left out here were that immediately when OPRA was enacted, the Governor McGreevy issued an executive order exempting home addresses and names. Then he rescinded it, and then it went to the Privacy Study Commission. And then, importantly, unlike, you know, like similar but even more specific than in Bozzi, the Privacy Study Commission specifically said email addresses, towns collect them on lists and send out newsletters and information. Someone could request them. We recommend that you create an exemption. And the legislature didn't. They exempted email addresses later, only with regard to hunting and fishing licenses. So this might be something that makes it into a bill.
In statutory construction, generally we don't look to things the legislature didn't do. We don't look at bills that didn't pass in any serious way, because we don't know why it didn't pass. We don't know whether it ever got to the point where anybody seriously considered it. Why is the Privacy Study Commission interaction with the legislature so much more probative than, for example, a bill that a legislator introduced that never got anywhere?
I think it's more probative because this court found it almost dispositive in Brennan and Bozzi, because it was they didn't exempt the information when they first created OPRA. Then they formed this commission to study the issues and to make recommendations. They received those recommendations and decided not to enact them, and instead later enacted other exemptions, not a broad-based one. They could have done that. They didn't. And so that's why I think it's different than other pending bills. We talk about them, but they don't carry as much weight.
Don't we look at the privacy study in the context of the executive order that was entered before OPRA came into being? Days before the law went into effect, the governor's executive order protected home phone numbers and the like, a direct acknowledgement that the law itself did not do so.
Correct, but the Privacy Study Commission was tasked with studying privacy issues, and this and the legislature created, it wasn't in the initial drafts of OPRA. There was all this discussion in this March 2000 hearing about privacy and how to protect it, and so they inserted, they created, then gave funding and created the Privacy Study Commission to recommend additional exemptions to it, and they didn't respond to...
But there's a lot of reasons not to provide a general exemption for email addresses. They may very well, in many instances, directly relate to things that OPRA is trying to, is enabling the public to obtain. It requires disclosure. But in an instance like this, where there does not appear to be on its face anything that is in any way related to the purpose of OPRA, and it only relates to this case and the email requests of this kind, that it doesn't seem to make any sense to require that the government reveal them, since it's just providing a list with no direct connection to government action. I can understand, I mean, in my mind, and I may be wrong, I can understand why government would not want to provide a general exception for email addresses versus other kinds of things like a home address, which is by character very different. But an email address, except this is a case when a specific request has been made without any apparent connection to a purpose that OPRA wants to foster.
I still disagree with the assessment that there's not any connection. It's that people want to interact with their government. They want to receive information about their government, and that's what my clients want to send. And
they they may want to interact with the government, but don't. Aren't we faced with the question of whether or not they could reasonably expect that by asking for this new newsletter to be emailed to them, that their information would be passed along to another agency? Different from Bozzi and Brennan, where there's some public-facing conduct on the part of the citizens. Here, where's that expectation? Where do we look for whether or not it was reasonable or not for them to assume that their information would be passed along?
I don't know, for example, how it's different than if you filed an OPRA request and your OPRA request is subject to access as well. It's interacting with the government, giving your information to the government, and my clients want to send them information about their government. There'll be many people that are happy to receive it, others that might hit the unsubscribe button when they receive it, others that might not get it because it goes into the spam filter.
I don't think filing an OPRA request can be characterized as passive in the same way that signing up for a township newsletter, perhaps about snow removal or about flooding in a part of town just because you want to hear that information. I don't think that you can consider that to be active in the same way that filing an OPRA request is. Someone has to actually specify what they're looking for. They're interacting with the government in that they're requesting certain information that they are delineating.
Well, fair enough. So if the court were to abandon the statutory analysis that I cited in Bozzi, which defers to the legislative inaction, then what do we have? It's not a denial of access. We are then in the privacy balancing test. And that's where we get to the fact. And the appellate division essentially held there was minimal harm to any privacy, but they found that my clients didn't have a need for the record or that it didn't advance government transparency. And that's where we strongly disagree. That's where I think derivative uses are important. And so if the court were to find that there is at least a colorable claim and then apply the privacy balancing test, we think it weighs in favor of access here. Maybe it wouldn't weigh in favor of the person who's going to send the dog fence spam, but it weighs in favor of here because my clients are two nonprofit organizations that share information. They do studies and reports about civil rights issues. For example, in Cherry Hill, they found reports, they did studies of the uses of force, found that there was a significant racial disparity in the use of force, and they want to send that information to the people who are interested in receiving information about the government. Even the GRC
interested in receiving information from the government.
About the government, from the government, about the government. I don't know.
When these individuals give their email address to the township, they are expecting to receive information about the township from the township. I don't think the expectation is that they will receive information from local nonprofits or the local coffee shop every time they have a discount or a sale, or the orthopedic shoes store or whatever. The expectation is that they're receiving information. Yes, they want information about the town from the town.
This court has always applied the privacy provision in very narrow circumstances where it was a very serious privacy violation. It's otherwise deferred to
the legislature. But there's no indication from the legislature in the plain language that that's how it's to be applied, correct? I heard you say before that, you know, this is only a safety provision that only would apply if someone would be personally harmed, but it just says a citizen's personal information with which it has been entrusted when disclosure thereof would violate the citizen's reasonable expectation of privacy. Is there some legislative history that you're relying on that says that it needs to be applied very narrowly, only in cases where there could be some type of physical safety issue, et cetera?
Well, I don't mean physical safety issue, but intimate details. That's when privacy comes up, and that's how this court has applied it. So financial applications for relief, the disclosure of millions of names and social security numbers, possible recordings of people being sexually assaulted, those sort of intimate private details, not this sort of mundane contact information that the legislature chose not to exempt.
But how would a recording of a sexual assault be someone's personal information? It seems like it actually is referring to mundane personal information, not traumatic experiences that are captured on video. I just don't see how those are generally called personal information in common parlance.
Well, I don't think I know the court wouldn't refrain from applying it in those highly intimate personal cases because the courts have applied it there or said that that might be the type of situation in which it would be applied. I don't think most people would want those sort of highly personal financial information or videos of them being intimately assaulted to be public, and I think that's the purpose of the privacy protection.
Yours is a very altruistic group that wants to do good things for the residents of these municipalities. But if this is permitted, then any private nonprofit could make this request and send out their newsletters. If you were representing the American Nazi Party, once we say yes, the answer is yes, you get it.
Well, that's what the legislature decided, but I would say that, again, the privacy balancing test doesn't end with just, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy? There is additional analysis. So if there's an intention to harm, those sort of things, that would be something that would come into the balance.
We have no idea. I mean, I understand the representations in the briefs regarding the party that you represent or any other party that comes in front of us with any other name that makes any other kind of representation. We don't know anything beyond that, but if this kind of information can be accessed, even though the people whose email addresses are in this bank have never done anything to involve the actions of the workings of government. They've never done that, but all of a sudden, their email addresses are going to go out to whoever asked for them. Yeah, it could be the orthopedic shoe, and I don't wear orthopedic shoes. I'm older than Justice Breyer, but I don't wear them.
That's an important matter for the record.
And I don't wear them. But it could go out to not just them, but it could go out to really offensive entities that have names and titles that are not as obvious as the American Nazi Party. There could be others. So where do we draw that line?
And at the end of the day, the person in Bozzi said he was going to send spam.
I'm not worried about Bozzi. In Bozzi, he asked for information regarding people who absolutely did involve themselves with some government action.
Not voluntarily.
No, not voluntarily. They have to do that. I'm not saying that. But there was government action involved. In this case, it's different. It's passive. There is no government action. These are notices. These are one-way communications. These are not people that are in distress, people that have to file for a license, people that have to ask the government to do something, whether they're required to do it or not.
And our position is the opposite, that disclosure of a home address is more harmful because it not only presents the annoyance, which is really the harm that's talking here, an annoyance. Like, none of us want to get spam.
Not necessarily.
I think it's an annoyance. No,
depends on the information that's being sent. The impact on the individual receiving it from the group that's received the list, I would not be so dismissive of what that impact would be on the person receiving it or what that invasion of privacy might do to the person receiving the information.
We would categorize it largely as annoyance. Nobody wants to get spam. Nobody also wants to get snail mail. Then you have to recycle it. But there's an extra threat that comes with disclosure of home addresses that doesn't come with email addresses. And that
there's nothing in either OPRA or the common law test that would permit the court to distinguish among groups. Your group. Your client pursuing civil rights, the American Nazi Party, to use Justice Solomon's example, not so much.
I think that there is in the balancing test because it talks about the public policy and the courts talked about the shedding the light on operations of government, and that's what they intend to do.
But if Oprah were, that would raise a First Amendment issue, wouldn't it? If Oprah were interpreted so that either the court or the government itself could say, not so much for this group. That political group, that nonprofit, we agree with their principles. They're not going to bother anybody. This other group is not. And all I'm saying is that any attempt to limit something on the basis of the content of the message is going to very quickly bump up against the First Amendment, is it not?
It could if it were, for example, that the court didn't agree with, considered a certain message like hateful, whereas this message isn't. But if the court has already referred to, and the appellate division did, the reason for needing it need to be something that reveals about the operations of government, and this request does that, then
but can't any group say, what I want to know about operations of government here is I want to know the names of the people so I can get my position across.
But that's not what we are claiming. That's not how maybe I'm not framing it right.
Oh, no, but
your
brief makes it clear. You're talking about in Cherry Hill, there's an interest in, we have an interest in illuminating government and illuminating perhaps law enforcement in a particular town or whatever, and therefore we are promoting ultimately by having access a broader and more critical look at government. But it seems to me that I don't want to say all, but the vast majority of groups that take positions on political issues and take positions on all kinds of issues, including issues that as to which emotions can be very high, can make the same claim. And to the extent that there's a suggestion that you could distinguish among groups based on the content, we're really running into First Amendment territory very quickly.
I think that in some ways that the balancing test invites that to some degree. So I think that if the police union wanted to get the list and send out a counter message that they don't think that there was disparities, then they would be equally entitled to it, and the court couldn't say that was less of about the operations of government. But if you're focusing on the operations of government being the test, what we're saying is that derivative uses should be considered, just like courts consider derivative negative.
And that's the two, you're presenting the two sides of the same coin, the your client taking the position that there's been racial disparities in Cherry Hill and in law enforcement, and potentially, hypothetically, the police union saying, oh, no, there hasn't. But once this is open, these emails are producible, it goes beyond that particular debate that, yes, it is focused on an activity of local government and gets into any political message that somebody wants to give the individuals on this list simply because they want to make a political point that could theoretically have an impact on the citizens. Because your case doesn't have, to me, as far as, and tell me if I'm wrong, a principled boundary that's going to keep
out situations like the hypothetical that Justice Solomon raised. And I'm not suggesting that's good or bad, but it is potentially, this case has potentially very far-reaching consequences. I think we need to consider that.
I think the far-reaching consequences should be considered by the legislature, and that they did consider it and didn't, from the commission that they formed to inform them about this, and they didn't act. And so I would ask the court to stand with that statutory analysis. I started by saying that we're going to have a robust debate today, and we will, and that some members of the court might not feel comfortable giving out the addresses, but I think that the statutory analysis is what has to control here. And I do think that if you're focusing on operations of government, it doesn't mean that anyone and everyone can get the list, and it doesn't mean that all lists would be accessible. It doesn't mean that the list of people who signed up because they need medical emergency care and those sort of lists are public. It means this generic list is, and the harm is someone might not like receiving the email, and they might unsubscribe. They could resubscribe with a different email address because email addresses are free to create, but it doesn't create the types of harm that could occur from disclosure of a home address. And so the disparity here would be that the court freely gave thousands of home addresses to the fence seller in Bozzi, but won't let the nonprofit organization trying to rebut government messaging to have the email addresses.
I understood your position as that there was no colorable expectation of privacy, no reasonable expectation of privacy here, so we don't need to go beyond that. But to the extent that the court would do so, can you give us an example of a group that would not be entitled to receive home email addresses making a request of the municipal government?
Well, I think, for example, if you were just saying, if Mr. Bozzi said, I want the email address, if you go into the privacy balancing test, which I don't think you do, but if Mr. Bozzi said, I want to send fence flyers via email because that's cheaper than when I had to do it by the home addresses, that doesn't fall within how the court has analyzed the privacy provision and saying it needs to be somewhat related to the operations of government. But I think that someone that's going to talk about something, the way in which a government is performing, the functions of government, that's why they want their records, then I do think it would fall.
I'm missing that. But Bozzi's, as I remember the Bozzi case, Mr. Bozzi wanted to send out some sort of ads.
Yes.
To all the dog owners in the community that for dog fencing, right?
Right.
Invisible fence. Am I right?
Right,
about
and
that?
The court didn't scrutinize his reason for the request because it found there was no colorable claim of privacy, largely in deference to the legislature's action and inaction. But if it had, then I don't know that the reason for that commercial request would have satisfied the privacy test.
Are you suggesting that there is an exception for a commercial interest? That seems a bit far from what I expected from you.
No, yeah. Well, if you get into the privacy balancing test, then you start scrutinizing the reason why someone wants the request. And the court has said that the reason needs to be, it said in Burnett, that the reason needs to be something relating to the operations of government. And so selling fences wouldn't be related to the operations of government, but wanting to send information about a campaign issue, about the local police department, that would be about something about the operations
of
government.
But that's transmission going the other way. It's not receiving information from government about how it operates. It's coming from the resident to the government that has nothing to do directly with how the government operates.
Right.
The transmission is going the opposite way of what you described.
And I think in that way, OPRA is wonderful because it's enabling the public to negate some of the messaging the government sends out. Yes,
that's
sometimes.
The public purpose that you're talking
about. I think it is a purpose.
That's the government purpose.
It is a purpose, I think.
And I meant, I'm saying that's the government
purpose. That's a government purpose, to allow the public to engage. So they can engage in so many different ways. They can receive records. They can write news articles about them. They can receive records. They can discuss them. They can show up at a town council. But then they can also use this particular list to negate the government's messaging. And so, yes, sometimes these lists are just, there's a flood on the street, avoid it. But other times these lists have been used to really just bolster the incumbents in an election season. And so this allows the public to bolster government, to counter government speech. And in it, even the GRC, which has very different decisions than this court, and this court has reversed it before, and it has held that dog licenses are addresses are not subject to OPRA. In the context of someone wanting to rebut government speech about campaigns, they allowed an email list to go out. And so what we're suggesting is not that every email list is going to be subject to access. I agree with the appellate division's decision in Brooks. It's important that those email addresses are subject to access, but that in this case, OPRA's core purpose is served, because a core purpose is civic engagement. And when people want to contact each other to shed information about the government, then that is serving its core purpose.
Anything you'd like to add at this point?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, I wanted to first address your question about pending OPRA amendments. I mean, to the best that I know, there are some pending bills in the Assembly, and there's work being done on the Senate side, but I really don't know anything more specific than that. I don't know if our colleagues representing the respondents can give more insight into that, but in terms of the issue of emails, one of the bills addresses emails, but in a very not nuanced way, so I don't think we're going to see any action, at least in terms of what's available now for public consumption. I don't know if we're going to see, and I don't think we're going to see any action specifically on emails, and even then, it's addressed as all emails, which would include even public entity emails, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But to get, to focus on some of the more deeply merits-related issues, Justice Solomon, you talked about essentially, disclose to one, disclose to all, and that is an issue, and your question, created even more discussion. If I accept the premise, which I do, for purposes of this argument, I'll accept the premise, that disclose to one means disclose to all, then the analysis, it's tempting to make the analysis about what's the basis use of the information. And I think that's exactly what you were saying. So do we disclose information to the petitioners here and risk disclosure to others who may not have good hearts? But that risk, and I think it's a risk, it's not a certainty, but it is a risk. That risk is the price we pay for transparency. That's the price. And there is a price to transparency, absolutely. And I think, Justice Solomon, you identified one of the risks, is that the information get into the wrong hands. But that risk is everywhere. And so I think the analysis should be, what is the harm that we're trying to prevent?
Well, isn't another important risk the concept that people who are just up to their eyebrows in unwanted emails are going to say, I didn't expect that, take me off your list, and word will get around because there are lots of communications and so on social media in communities where people said, you realize that if you give off this, this is going to be publicly available, your email will, and that people will stop getting communications from government that may, in fact, impact their safety. It may warn them of hazards. It may warn them of wires down in a thunderstorm and don't go on this road because there's a flood and schools getting out early and all of these things that people have to should have access to in order to be living safely in their communities.
Justice Patterson, I accept the premise that we're going to put that in the risk column. I'll accept that premise, that disclosure may cause some folks to opt out. I agree. I would respond in two different ways. The first way is there are many ways for people to get public information. The technology is advanced in so many ways.
Folks, and there's many ways for these organizations to populate their listservs without having to go through the government to get it. Correct?
There are.
Why does the government have to be the clearinghouse for commercial businesses, nonprofits, and any entity that wants to populate their listserv? Why should how is OPRA turning into the primary method for an organization to just get a bunch of lists and information on people? Because that's the easiest way to populate their own, Excel spreadsheets so that they have a lot of folks to contact. You just said technology is advanced in a tremendous amount of ways. There are many other ways for these organizations, for people, selling, dog fences everywhere. There are many other ways for this information to be obtained without going through the government, which I just don't think that's the that is what the legislature envisioned in passing OPRA.
Justice Kerr, I acknowledge that because of technology, government creates a massive amount of data, of paper, of emails. And a lot of that is about individuals. And on the one hand, I understand the argument that, well, why should certain folks get a free ride? Number one, it is a taxpayer expense. So that data, there is the perspective that data belongs to the public. It doesn't belong to the government. It belongs to the public. It's being held in trust by the government, which means that sometimes the OPRA requests have to be denied. But that information, those documents, are owned by the people, by the public, being held in trust. So that's what we're really discussing today.
Their email addresses are owned by the government and held in trust, even though when they give their email address, they believe they're private.
The issue is, what is the reasonable expectation of privacy? I think that, and this is also addressing some of the several questions I've heard today, it's whether the expectation is reasonable. I think, first, most folks would be shocked to hear about the type of information that's disclosable about them. So foreclosures, mortgages, defaults, tickets, DWIs, videos of people on the side of the road, being pulled over. I think most folks would be shocked at what most attorneys would consider to be reasonable disclosures. But that being said, I want to turn a little bit to really what I think is the core of your inquiry, Justice Solomon, which is that how would disclosure of these email addresses illuminate the function of government? And I would add to the robust discussion that my colleague made today, I would add that email lists can be abused. Email lists can be abused. And my colleague here sort of hinted at it when they said, okay, in election season, there might be an uptick in the notices. Well, what if the email lists are downloaded to spreadsheets by a public employee and then given to other folks, given to campaigns, used in other ways, abused, shared privately?
I don't know the answer to this. I assume there may be that if someone in government discloses to a political campaign for political purposes an email address where people have just simply submitted their names, I don't know, but it seems to me that there might be a law out there that affects that. I haven't looked that up, but is there?
I don't know the answer. I am inclined to agree with you, Justice Patterson. However, I don't counsel folks to start with an accusation. I would counsel folks to say, start making OPRA requests. If you think there's wrongdoing in your municipality, and by the way, I think there usually isn't.
Of course.
It starts with an OPRA
request. But OPRA requests, we've had many cases this court has heard and many more that have not gotten to this court, where people have access to information about potential wrongdoing in their communities by all kinds of means and different categories of documents. But we're talking about somebody who's not doing anything right, wrong, or indifferent, somebody who's simply getting information from government. So I think your advice to clients is on the mark. You make OPRA requests to see if you can ferret out wrongdoing in government. But we're talking about lists of citizens and emails of citizens. We're not talking about something peculiar going on in the halls of government.
Yes, there may be a price to be paid. If folks are giving their email addresses to government and that information is being abused, and that's a hypothetical. Like I said, most public employees don't break the law, but
how would one affect the other? So if we were to affirm the appellate division's decision in this case, which just held that the list of the individual email addresses who signed up for the newsletter could not be disclosed in the circumstances of this case, what does that have any impact on a future OPRA request about a political or about a public official who misused their office to give government information out inappropriately? I'm just not sure I understand the connection.
Let's say that a member of one of our organizations suspects that someone is sharing data and information contained in these email lists. which it may be limited to an email, but we live in the world of metadata and cookies, so it may or may not be limited to private email addresses. So let's say someone suspects that, but they're a reasonable person. They're not going to blog about it. They're not going to shoot off letters to the prosecutor's office. They want to build their case. So they will start with an OPRA request, and that OPRA request could be, please provide me with the email addresses. And so maybe they can take that data and compare it to other data they have, which could confirm suspicion.
Isn't there a little more direct way to go about that? And that is, give me all the email addresses that have anything to do with this database and what's happened to it, and any disclosures outside of the town of whatever. Wouldn't that be a much more directed way to find out if somebody is disclosing to a political campaign or to whomever this email address that we're here talking about today? You're saying get the email address as a way of finding out if it's been misused?
Yes. If we have two data sets, one data set of folks who have received emails from a political campaign, in my hypothetical, and then we have our second data set, which is the email list that's within the custody and control of the governmental entity.
But why
you compare the two?
But instead of comparing the two, why couldn't someone just file an OPRA request for all emails that sent out this data set? If it's sent from a government official, and it's a government official sending out information, that has nothing to do with the holding of this case and would not be unavailable, even if the appellate division's decision were affirmed.
I think perhaps, Justice, but I'm focusing on the use of the specific emails as opposed to the communications being sent, because I feel like I'm working very hard to address Justice Solomon's concern about
that's a first.
It's the second, I think.
The first in the case, generally. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thinking about this case, that's the hardest question. Well, one of the hardest questions that we have to answer, and I don't think that question surprised us, which is how does that involve the operation of government? And I think that ultimately there is a price to be paid in disclosure for lots of kinds of information, not just email addresses, but who's getting contracts, tax delinquencies, who's getting notices of violation and who's not.
Respectfully, those are very different situations, as are the scenarios that you talked about before, DWIs, the criminal activity of people, the foreclosures and so forth. Those are all individual situations in which people have had very significant interactions with government. Because in a foreclosure, government has a major role. But all the people here that we're talking about here today did, as far as this record discloses, say, yeah, I'll sign up for the snow alerts. That's all.
Right, and that's...
Counsel, if I could just interrupt for a sec. We're going to be at 15 minutes very soon. In answering this question, perhaps you want to come through the front door and succinctly tell us why this information should be disclosed as you understand OPRA.
Because we can't predict the ways in which this information in the hands of municipalities can be abused. And to limit future potential abuse, there should be access.
So the best.
It sounds to me like you're saying that the way in which it would be abused would be that it would be disclosed. And so we have to disclose it in order to find out how it could be disclosed. I'm just not sure why that is, how it's relevant. I mean, there are many ways that one could ferret out government abuse by sending an OPRA request, for example, for all times that this information was disclosed that have nothing to do with the people then getting spam from the coffee company or the orthopedic shoe company.
Well, it is, right. It is a bit of a conundrum. How do you prevent abuse without access to the information? Yes, but then that...
You have
access the information because you can file an OPRA request for every time this information was disclosed without getting the underlying email addresses that were on the list. I'm not sure why the underlying email addresses are relevant if what you're trying to disclose... figure it out is when they were inappropriately turned over.
To mash up the underlying data. That's why.
Was that the purpose here? Is it to match? Oh, you're talking about hypothetically.
Hypothetically. Right. That's sort of like the elephant in the room. Do we look at our requesters or do we look at the worst case scenario?
I would think there would be, assuming the assumption that I think you and I both have, that there that it is illegal for someone to hand off a list like this to a political campaign to help that campaign. I don't know the answer to that, but if that's true, I would think there's some very direct ways to go at this that don't involve matching up data sets.
Or if what you're saying is that this can never be prevented from discoverability under OPRA, then wouldn't political campaigns just be able to get it by filing an OPRA request for the list in the same way that the nonprofit in this case did? That's why I'm so confused about it. If you win and the answer is this must always be disclosed, then there is no one who can't get it anymore, and there is no wrongful disclosure anymore, and anyone who wants can always file an OPRA request to get it, including a political campaign.
I mean, in that hypothetical, perhaps, but I don't know if it would be in everyone's interest just to email folks unsolicited. I don't know that that necessarily be in anyone's best interest.
Council, I want to take a step back and ask you to finish this sentence. OPRA begins with a broad statement about how the statute should be construed in favor of the public's right of access. And then it provides an exception, privacy exception. The privacy exception should not apply in this case because?
To deter future abuse of government-held government-held email lists.
So it should be disclosed to keep it from being disclosed.
To keep it from being abused. There's disclosure and then there's abuse.
You may eliminate any kind of abuse because if it's public, there's no need for anybody to hand it off to the political campaign. They've got it. Right? Not sure that's...
Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Miles.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. The questions before the court today are whether residents have a reasonable expectation to privacy in the personal email addresses they provide to their local government for the limited purpose of passively receiving newsletters and updates. And if so, whether an outside organization seeking a shortcut to generate an audience for its own messaging has a sufficient need or sufficiently advances the goals of OPRA to outweigh that privacy interest. These questions are narrow ones. Answering them does not require the court to establish sweeping new rules. The tests have already been articulated by this court, and it is merely necessary to apply them to the specific and unique facts and circumstances of this case. That analysis begins with the plain language of OPRA itself, which commands custodians of record to protect residents' personal information when they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. This court in Brennan has indicated that when determining whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, you look first to whether there is a colorable claim. Colorable, Black's Law Dictionary tells us, is something appearing to be true or valid or right. A colorable claim is defined as one that may reasonably be asserted. The statute and this court's analysis does not require prescience or mind reading. Only a colorable claim that residents have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, OSSI tells us the distinction between actions that or information typically kept private or those extended to the public is important to this analysis. personal emails are very often private. I said very often, not always, because, of course, the circumstances are important. The circumstances drive what is reasonable. Circumstances include to whom is the email address provided. There's a big difference, I would submit, between providing an email address to an online retailer versus providing an email address to your local government. The expectation is different, and reasonably so. The circumstances also include what purpose the email address is being provided for. Is it provided to debate an issue of public importance, or to conduct business with a municipality, to obtain a license or a permit, or simply to passively receive newsletters and alerts? The greater the interaction with government, the greater the benefit potentially received from the government, the less reasonable the expectation of privacy. Here, we're talking about personal email addresses provided for a very limited and passive purpose, to receive updates about local news, things like leaf collection, things like flooding, things like community events. Email addresses are very often private, as I said, for good reason, because our email addresses often include information about us. Many of us include all or part of our name in our email address. Some of us include portions of our date of birth or other things that identify us in some way. And the domain names attached to our email addresses very often have the potential to disclose information about us as well, perhaps where we work, perhaps a university we attend or did attend. Email addresses are also very often kept private because with their disclosure comes some level of risk. We're all familiar with spam email, but more importantly, malware, phishing attacks, and keystroke capture devices. It's now possible, as we've learned from the articles cited by the parties and the Friends of the Court, that clicking on a link in an email can result in the information you type onto your screen being captured and transferred to the person on the other side. We all know the sensitive nature of the information that we engage with on our computers on a daily basis. So there is some level of risk, some reason why people have an expectation for privacy. Because a reasonable expectation of privacy that is colorable exists here, the analysis of the court proceeds to a balancing test. The court's called upon to weigh both the strong public interest in disclosure with the interest in privacy. And in doing so and applying the Doe factors, considers a number of criteria. It's important here to recognize who's requesting this information and for what purpose it's being requested. The petitioner has described the admirable work that they do. However, they cannot change the request itself. They're not seeking information, they're seeking an audience. And there's been discussion this morning about whether the goals of OPRA are being advanced by that type of request. The answer is no. And the answer is no for a simple reason. In making that assessment, we can't get into the business of judging the speech of the requester. You know, certainly that does raise the type of First Amendment concerns that have been raised this morning. Instead, you look at the connection between the record itself, its intended use, and the goals of OPRA. a group that's concerned about policing may request records about arrests or perhaps body camera footage. And the connection between that request and the goals of OPRA is the important consideration there. It's very different from the goals of an organization when the requested information, again, is not information itself, it's an audience. We want the names of who we can contact. There's no connection between that request and the goals of OPRA. It shines no light on the operations of government. It does not provide the opportunity for any type of oversight or watchdog function. The connection is nothing. And for that reason, the risks here, the expectation of privacy on one side of the scale, the risk that people are dissuaded from receiving the updates from their community, as has also been suggested this morning, they sit on one side of the scale. On the other side of the scale is nothing. Because requesting an audience versus information does not advance the goals of OPRA. This court has not, in its previous decisions in the context of OPRA, been asked to consider a case where the connection between the records sought and the operation of government was so attenuated, or one where the need for the information was so limited. For that reason, in conducting the Doe analysis and balancing these factors, which is appropriate given the colorable claim that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy, the specific facts and circumstances of this case make it appropriate to affirm the appellate division's limited holding. Other circumstances, as have been speculated to this morning, may result in future cases which may justify different conclusions. But on the facts and circumstances present before this court, privacy should carry the day.
You've emphasized the importance in your mind of the nature of the organization. Which of the Doe factors are you relying on for that?
Yes. Factor 7 considers whether there is any express statutory mandate, articulated public policy, or other recognized public interest that would militate towards access. So in the context of that factor, the purpose for the request is considered. Now, Burnett has explained that generally as an opening matter, when considering a reasonable expectation of privacy, the court does not concern itself with why the records are requested. And certainly that was the case in Brennan, it was the case in Bosie. The court never got to step two. It was satisfied because of the connection between the individuals and their government, the benefits that were being derived in those cases, the case of public auction to purchase government-seized property or to obtain a license from the government to engage in pet ownership, that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy. And so the interest of the requester was never considered in those cases. But going a step further here and reaching those Doe factors, it is appropriate, as Burnett suggested, to ask whether the disclosure will further the core purposes of OPRA. And in doing that, we examine the reason for the request.
Do you have anything else to add, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Flynn.
Good morning, Your Honors. I will largely adopt what my colleague has said on the side of the respondents. I'll just add a couple brief points, notably to the seventh Doe factor, which we've discussed. We believe our position actually does advance the purposes of OPRA, and that is militating towards government participation and transparency. The appellate division here was presented with companion cases, as you all know, our case and the Brooks case down in Tabernacle Township. And the appellate division's analysis really distinguished between passive and active participation in government. In our case, a resident merely enters their email to sign up for the limited mailing list to receive township alerts and updates. In Brooks, conversely, there, the individual residents were directly emailing members of the township committee and employees of the township about township functions. And I think that distinction is very important here. We don't suggest that emails would not be discoverable under OPRA in a situation in which there is active participation with your elected officials and the administration of the municipality. Instead, here what we have is we have a passive sign-up for township alerts and updates. There's no interaction with any township officials. It's just a residents merely seeking to be informed about current events of their township or, in some instances, emergency alerts. We've discussed flooding, road closures, trees maybe have fallen and impacted road circulation. And so for that reason, I do believe the appellate division's opinion should be affirmed. And it is this specific question of deterrence that was brought up by some of our residents who decide to sign up for these alerts and updates. I don't believe that the expectation of a resident who enters their email address on a township website to receive township alerts is reasonably expecting to receive all sorts of solicitations, whether commercial or not, from any type of organization. And notably, we know that today's political climate is a bit difficult, and I would posit that a township citizen who decides to sign up for these alerts and is then spammed by all sorts of political organizations, whether they agree or disagree with the fundamental message of that organization, they may be deterred from signing up in the future. They may discontinue their membership. And as a result, they're actually less informed about the inner workings of the township. They're less informed about any emergency alerts, which may be important for the township to circulate. And therefore, it creates less dialogue with local government, and it creates less transparency because it may lead to local residents wanting to be less involved with their local officials. Specifically with respect to the point that's raised in plaintiff's brief about the broad judicial exemption for email addresses, should the court hold in our favor as opposed to theirs? As I've just said, there is a way, and the appellate division did, to distinguish between the types of interactions in which your email address may be used with your local government. On one hand, they may be active communications in which you are actually acting on your own behalf and attempting to influence government policy. That's your active participation with the local government. That's what Brooks held. Here, we distinguish and we have a passive form of interaction with your local government, in that I'm just going to receive the alerts. I can't reply to these alerts. If I do reply, it doesn't go anywhere. It's not as if I'm taking these township lists and then replying to a message I get in my email that my local official is going to be able to see what I say in response. And so therefore, the court is empowered to find that the resident in this case's expectation of privacy is reasonable. And the legislature did empower courts to, on a case-by-case basis, determine whether or not the expectation of privacy in personal information is reasonable. The idea that holding
Let's say hypothetically you don't have a do not reply type of emails, listserv, or whatever it may be. You have an ability to reply. Is the dividing line between passive and active interaction with government the reply that said, well, you said there's flooding on Market Street, but what part of Market Street?
Right.
I mean, a sort of innocuous question of just seeking clarity on a flooding situation. Is that put that over the line of active into active?
Right. I think in the facts in this case, if you receive those alerts, it's not as if you reply that your reply would go to your local official. Now, I think if you were to then say, oh, I got this alert. I'm not sure if my road's closed. I'm going to then reach out to DPW and see if the road closure. I think that is maybe a different analysis, in which case this court may hold that that's more active.
Or you call, or you do, the citizen does something in addition to receiving the information. That's active.
That's very different than just the receipt of a email that says, here's what's going on in Bridgewater or Cherry Hill or West Deptford Township. And so my final comment would just be that, again, the courts are the arbiter of the privacy exception. There's a reason it exists. It's not as if in this case we're asking the court to say, in all forms of communication with local government, private emails should be redacted when a records custodian responds to an OPR request. That's not as far-reaching as we're suggesting here. Instead, what we're suggesting is in this limited circumstance where we have this passive receipt of information, the resident's expectation of privacy, that they will not, as a result of signing up for that, be solicited by all manners of organizations, that expectation of privacy in their private email is reasonable in this case. And we'd ask the court to not only affirm what the appellate division did here, but also see the rationale between the difference between our case and Brooks.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, three quick points, and I'll start where my friend from Bridgewater left off, which is there was a lot of talk early on about deference to the legislature to make these changes. But in fact, deference to the legislature must be full, and it must recognize that one of the things the legislature did was, with respect to privacy, ceded part of that authority on a case-by-case basis to, in the first instance, custodians, and in the second instance, courts. The legislature created the privacy exemption, and for the reasons Justice Wiener after explored, thought it meant something, thought there would be some play in the joints for custodians to figure out where a reasonable expectation of privacy exists. That does not mean that there's a categorical exemption for email addresses, and the appellate division didn't impose one. In the appellate division, Rise Against Hate appended a series of unpublished opinions, and at PA 33, they appended Secondary Parents Council versus Newark, which was a discussion about so Governor Christie and then Mayor Booker went on to the Oprah Winfrey Show to announce $100 million for Newark schools that they had obtained from Mark Zuckerberg.
That was Oprah with an H.
That was Oprah with an H. But then there was an Oprah with an A, although both have A's, Oprah without an H, to say, tell us how this came about.
They both have A's.
They both have O's also. But to say, how did this money come about? And in Judge Davidson's opinion, she draws a distinction, because there's lots of private-private email, there's public-public email, and there's public-private email. And she says, when someone emailed then-Mayor Booker to talk about this, well, they're interacting with government. That's active. That gets disclosed. But when two private entities emailed one another, they didn't think they were interacting with government, even if later one of them forwarded it to government. The person who didn't forward it, his or her email address is private. That distinction is exactly an appropriate one here. And there was a question, I believe plaintiff's counsel asked, how is it different from filing in OPRA? And I want to spend a minute on that, because the passive receipt of information here, let's think about what that looked like in a world before email. I guess at one point a town crier would say, you know, careful, there's a tree down, can't bring your horse and buggy there.
Is that true, Justice Solomon?
At I'm going to just move past that.
Keep going.
And then later, people would post signs on a bulletin board. There may have come a time where people actually read newspapers, and there would be public announcements listing those things. There was a time when there were phone calls made. Now we've moved to email. It doesn't make it more active because the technology has changed. This is the sort of thing that people receive information and don't have to respond. And
so what is the dividing line? Same question I asked your
partner. So I think there are three categories of information, Justice Patterson, and two are easy. So when someone is trying to influence government, so if they write back and say, no, don't close Main Street, instead you should close Broad Street, that would be a better street to close. Of course that gets disclosed. That's on the one poll. On the other poll is someone simply received the information. They don't respond. That, in our view, clearly doesn't get disclosed. In the middle is the innocuous clarifying question. You say Main Street, does that include Main between 3rd and 4th, or whatever, the clarifying question? My hunch is we probably don't want custodians getting into that level of minutia, and so you could draw an easy line at reply is active, don't reply is passive.
What is your second pillar? Can you tease that out just a little bit more?
The middle one?
Receiving information, no.
If you just received information.
Who's the you?
A resident of the town receives the information and they don't reply. So they've now learned that Main Street is closed and they've done with that information whatever they will. That is someone who is passively receiving information. They're not, it's a one-way street. They're getting information from the government and not bringing anything back to the government. I think probably my second category, those who ask the clarifying question, probably does open it up to no longer being passive. I think that's probably, from an administrability standpoint, the easiest. I want to end by talking for a second about this question of what are the harms and what are the ways to mitigate the harms. There was a back and forth in the briefs between Rising and State and the ACLU on that question. And, plaintiff brought up lots of ways people can mitigate that harm. But it got me thinking a lot about my dear departed grandparents who they never quite understood voicemail, such that they would sign voicemails like they would a letter. Love, Omi, at the end of every voicemail. And when we finally got them an AOL address, they would start with the date, and then it would say, Dearest Alex, and they'd tab over to start the next thing, and it was like a formal letter. Had they lived in Cherry Hill or West Deptford or whatever, they would have signed up for this because they wanted to be active in their government. But if they started getting emails about orthopedic shoes or about coffee shops, they would have been overwhelmed by it because they didn't understand how to easily just report to spam or unsubscribe. They would have read every word of every email that they received, and it would have made it harder for them to participate in government. So it's true. You can create an alias email account on Gmail, but they couldn't. They had a collective email address on AOL, and they're entitled to receive information from the government. And because it's easier for the government to send out emails than it is to use a town crier or a bulletin board, that's how most information gets displayed. And so if people remove themselves from it, there is real and active harm. And so that's not even talking about the malfeasance of third parties. And I think just one really, really quick word on that, which is there was an interesting conversation about could you give things to Rise Against Hate and not to the American Nazi Party, and I think I agree that that would be viewpoint discrimination and forbidden by the First Amendment. But what's worse is if you allow this to happen, if you allow Rise Against Hate to obtain this, they might not intend to sell it, but the American Nazi Party could then also sell it to every, I mean, I don't know why they would actually have to sell it because anyone could just file the Oprah, but any commercial entity, the orthopedic shoes, the coffee shop, could all get it. So all of our concerns about misuse, that it's going to be used by political, well, it wouldn't be misuse, it would just be use because it would be public information at that point. And so I think there were lots of questions that, in response to Mr. Lohr's, that suggested if you're worried about abuse, it's going to the wrong person. And you file a different Oprah that doesn't require the email addresses. In Rise Against Hate's brief, they cited to instances of abuse where gadflies had been removed from email lists, which is troubling. But one can conceive of how to file an OPRA request that doesn't require finding out everyone's email address. You could say, tell me if John Smith is on your email list, for example. The public purpose there is very clear. Or you could even say, if you're worried that johnsmith@gmail.com has been removed, just send me the part of the email addresses before the at sign to at least give you some information about that. So there are ways to do it that don't require the disclosure of every member of the community's email address. Unless there is any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Woodward.
Thank you, Your Honor, and the courts. I've listened for the last hour and a half to extraordinary argument, and I must say that all the things that I thought about ahead of time saying have been said, so I'm going to be very, very brief. The fact of the matter is, it's been argued by the plaintiff that what we're seeking is an overarching exemption under OPRA. In fact, because OPRA itself includes the privacy provision in its very first paragraph, the only thing that's overarching is that there is a right of privacy. And plaintiff's position would, I think, as this court has already stated in the course of the argument, said that, you know, well, then what's left? And I would agree with that. I think that the appellate division here did the right thing. It correctly analyzed Burnett, Brennan, and Bozzi. And obviously, and I concur with the approach that in analyzing the appellate division decision, you have to look at the unreported Brooks versus Tabernacle, which clearly sets forth the difference between engagement with the government or the passive receipt of information. I'm not going to go into any of the other points that I want to make at this point because they've already been made. I do, however, want to close with the point that in Doe versus Poritz, Justice Brandeis, his point in his dissent in the Olmstead case, I think is most salient here. That is, quote, the right to be let alone is the most important, most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by a civilized society. That's it here. You know, if I submit a request for information, sign up and get it, and I get that information and I do nothing more, I just want to be let alone. That's fundamental. It's fundamental to the jurisprudence of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's fundamental to this court's jurisprudence. And I submit that under the circumstances that the case here, the appellate division decision, should be respectfully affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brief rebuttal, counsel.
I have a few quick points. The first that the defendants are seeking categorical exemption. Categorical exemption for email distribution lists. The very record that the Privacy Study Commission warned the legislature would be accessible, but the legislature did not act. And so I would say again that this is a debate for the legislature, and we will maybe have it, because Justice Pierre-Louis, you used the phrase, the government being a clearinghouse for information for all these organizations and companies. And that is the current political debate right now. Clerks and the League of Municipalities very much dislike, especially commercial requests, because attorneys request traffic tickets to send solicitations. Businesses request land use records. There's many of these requests that come in that these parties claim don't have anything to do with the operations of government, and they are a burden on the agencies. And so that's been the discussion in the proposed legislation, how to cure especially commercial requests So far, the proposals, I don't believe, have been to exempt information, but rather to charge commercial requesters and that sort of thing. It's a debate for the legislature. Should they exempt information? Should they instead charge for it? Should they treat some requesters different than other requesters? But a core purpose of OPRA is not to treat people, not to consider the reason for a request. Justice Wainwrighter, I want to go back to the question you had earlier, because the first paragraph about why courts should construe the privacy provision narrowly only for serious harms. And the reason is the first paragraph of OPRA actually isn't the privacy provision. It is the line that you quoted, Chief Justice, that every limitation on the right of access is to be construed narrowly in favor of public access. And that includes the privacy provision too. And so this court has always applied it sparingly. There's lots of things that are accessible under OPRA that we probably don't really want to be accessible, but because of various laws or statutes, they have to be. So a DWI, most people probably don't want the public seeing it, but it will be accessible. Probably most of the dog license owners complied with the law and didn't want their home address out there, but it was accessible. And so one of my larger concerns about this case and the comments today would be expanding the privacy provision and allowing courts to use it more freely than they have, because agencies make a privacy claim in so many cases where there's really not a privacy claim. And the court's decision in Brennan, where for the first time they put that safeguard in place and said there needs to be an analysis, that there's a colorable claim before you got to the balancing test, really helped solve that problem some. Regarding the particular purpose here and the distinction between passive and passive receipt of information and affirmatively contacting the government, I don't know that it's necessarily the best line. I don't know that people, when they contact the government, also assume that everybody's going to find out about their communications. Sometimes you contact the government just because you want help. But I think that all of this falls within the definition of government record and should be accessible. And so this particular request, we disagree that you need to go to the balancing test based on FOSI, but if the court does, Burnett suggests that you would look at how the record could be used. Even if the record on its face does not reveal something about the operations of government, which the land use records there didn't, the court still said that the balancing test would be different if someone were going to use it in a way that revealed something about the operations of government. And that's what my clients certified under oath when they signed a verified complaint intend to do. They intend to use the list to share information about the police department and other civil rights issues, and that is a core benefit of OPRA, to encourage civic participation, to encourage public debate, and this case enables it. And so if the court were to create this exemption in this case, there would be the disparity that the dog license seller was able to send his snail mail spam to all of the residents of Jersey City. But my client, a civil rights organization that wants to talk about the local police department and problems with it, would not be able to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.